This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the publication of Bram Stoker's classic gothic tale, Dracula. We're celebrating that event with an interview with one of the world's leading authorities on Dracula and horror, Leonard Wolf. His latest book on the subject is Dracula, A Connoisseur's Guide. He's also developing a series on young Dracula for DC Comics.
Well, I'm thinking about Bram Stoker, and much has been made of his relationship with the actor Henry Irving, who was one of the more popular actors at the late 19th century. Bram Stoker was actually a manager at the theater where Henry Irving performed. How would you describe how Bram Stoker saw his relationship with this rather famous actor, Henry Irving?
Well, in my book, I've taken a terrible risk. I have outed Bram Stoker. And I say very carefully that I'm speculating. But what the speculation is based on, the details of the lives they led together. Bram Stoker fell in love with Henry Irving very early in his own career. And then Irving invited him to come and work for him in London. And for some 28 years, Stoker was a loyal, dutiful, even slavish servant for Henry Irving. And what I have suggested in my book is that it's the unhappy part of Stoker's life was that he never could confront the fact that he was in love with Irving, and he never did anything about what I think is the incipient homosexuality, which he betrayed in other ways. There are a series of letters he wrote to Walt Whitman, for example, that make it very, very clear that he admired Whitman for what he imagined was Whitman's comfort with his own homosexuality. It's a heartbreaking story, the way in which Stoker spent his life not coming to terms with his own deepest hungers.
Well, you write about and actually pull from Bram Stoker's own either letters or diaries about seeing this actor Henry Irving perform, and he really falls into a kind of a swoon as he sees him this very famous actor performing on stage, and it's almost melodramatic.
It's a heartbreaking story because. Yeah. Irving recited a poem, a really soppy poem, and Stoker fainted dead away at the sound and the sight of it. And then later, Irving gave him a copy of a photograph of his signed with his name, and it was a sort of moment of profound, a high point in Stoker's life. The bystander, we who read this story 80 or 90 years later, can't help feeling that he could not bring himself to acknowledge what had happened. And I think that that's too bad.
And are you saying, because certainly when you read through Dracula, it's about many things, but what you're also saying is that it really has this kind of homoerotic subtext?
I said long ago, I've created an edition of Dracula called The Essential Dracula, in which I have notes for every moment in the fiction, which I think requires some note. There are moments when Dracula says, for example, to the three women who want Jonathan Harker, and Dracula drives them away, and he says, "This man is mine." And Dracula looks deep into Stoker's eyes. Well, that's not a moment in which, he's behaving like Robin Hood. What that is a homoerotic exchange, which is never fully developed. And there have been other scholars who have gone to considerable lengths to demonstrate the degree to which Stoker either avoided confronting homosexual moments in the novel or inadvertently put them in.
Mm. You said, and I don't know whether this was a slip on your part, but that Dracula looked into Stoker's eyes as opposed to Jonathan Harker's eyes. But do you see them almost as one in the same?
Well, what I'm doing, and it's really unpardonable, one has no right to deduce from the life of a writer a clear link to the contents of a fiction by that writer. I think that's an exercise in facile criticism, and I've just done it, and I would like to step back a little bit from it. What I'm willing to say is Stoker's mind and his unconscious were in turmoil, they were in such turmoil that when he sat down to write Dracula, the turmoil itself produced the energy that resulted in the vision and the language and the plot line that produced a very great novel.
When you review all the movies that have been made about Dracula, which one do you think comes the closest to your image, your version of Dracula?
Well, that's another one of these wonderful questions, because what you're asking me to do is to be the god of the Dracula movie business, and that would be great for fun to be. I have to say first that I don't hold the movies responsible for interpreting Bram Stoker's novel exactly. Mm-hmm. I think film is an art form all unto itself, and fiction is an art form unto itself. They can influence each other, but they do not need to interpret each other. Having said that, the film that moves me most is Dracula's Daughter, because it has a scene in it in which Gloria Holden plays Dracula's daughter, who, now that Dracula is dead, hopes that the curse of vampirism will leave her life and she can become an ordinary woman. And, of course, the rest of the film demonstrates that she can't. It's a very poignant, poignant film, beautifully realized in the scenes of ritual, particularly when she's burying her father. Beyond that, Coppola's film did its best to include most of the scenes that Stoker has written. Stoker's novel, you know, is overpopulated. It has, from a movie point of view, it has too many characters. And Coppola has managed to retain them all. And what the James Hart Coppola version does, however, is that it inverts Stoker's story and turns what Stoker thought of as the good guys into the bad guys. Dr. Van Helsing and his troop are trying to prevent Vlad Tepes from uniting with his true love, whom he has been looking for the last 400 years. So that in an important sense, it's a heretical interpretation. But I like to think and am delighted to see that the films are endlessly reinventing Dracula, which is the right thing for a great symbol, the right way to treat a great symbol.
Well, I know that you're in the process of creating a young Dracula for DC Comics. And some people have said that when you look at Dracula over the last 100 years, he's getting younger and younger. Do you agree with that?
Well, what else he's getting is nicer
yes,
and nicer.
Right, right.
and that seems to me too bad. when you have that probably happened most dramatically with Frank Langella's Dracula. I've called Frank Langella's Dracula the cuddly Dracula, because it's hard for me to imagine any woman looking into Langella's eyes who wouldn't give up, you know, some portion of eternity to be his victim for a little while. They are getting nicer and nicer, and there has been a reversal of moral meaning for the vampires, so that in the works of Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough, for example, we have a vampire who is profoundly nice. He's decent, he's law-abiding, he's rich, he wears a cross, and he only takes as much blood from his willing victims as will nourish him. I think something will disappear from vampire literature when the vampires become nice guys.
So your young Dracula, is he a nice guy or a nasty guy?
Well, what I've done in my young Dracula is to give the world for the very first time a clear, coherent, and terrifying explanation for why he drinks blood. I won't tell you here and now. Obviously, come.
Well, there's the suspense, right? Which
that's,
is, of course, very important part of this story.
That's the idea. No, I treat him very sympathetically, but he sustains a terrible, he has a dreadful experience that therefore turns him into the monster we now have. But until that experience, he's a nice guy.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Leonard Wolf, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Leonard Wolf is the author of Dracula, A Connoisseur's Guide. He's working on a young Dracula series for DC Comics due out later this year. And this fall, Oxford University Press will publish an anthology edited by Leonard Wolf called Bloodthirst, 100 Years of Vampire Fiction. This is Fresh Air. Jackie Robinson broke baseball's color line 50 years ago and became a hero to every black child who dreamed of playing in the major leagues. But today, the percentage of African-American players playing professional baseball is just 17%, well behind basketball and football. My guest, John Young, wants to reverse that trend. In 1989, he founded RBI, Reviving Baseball in Inner Cities. It's supported by funds from Major League Baseball and works to increase interest in the sport by organizing teams and tournaments. It also works with boys and girls, encouraging them to stay in school. Today, there are RBI programs in 75 cities across the country, and beginning this weekend, they hold their World Series championship at Coors Field in Denver. John Young played baseball as a kid in South Central L.A. where he grew up and was offered $500 a month to play pro ball. His father said no, he had to go to college first. Well, after graduation, Young played first base in the minor leagues through most of the 1970s. An injury curtailed his major league career with the Detroit Tigers. He then worked as a scout for the Tigers. We first spoke last spring, and I asked him when he first noticed baseball was disappearing from inner city neighborhoods.
The first week I became a scout. I was living in Alabama at the time, Montgomery, and I was working with the Tigers, and I had four states, so Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Florida, and Georgia, five states. And as I would travel into Birmingham, New Orleans, Atlanta, all the major cities, you know, in those states, and scout the high school players, I really noticed a difference in the participation with African Americans and the quality of the programs in the inner city schools. As we scouted the colleges, we would notice that unless it was a historically black school, there weren't many African Americans playing college baseball. So right away, it was just so noticeable.
What was the concept then behind the program that you started? Again, this was in the late 80s, this program called RBI.
I moved up to Detroit as director of scouting, and I really, as we would attend baseball organization meetings with other scouting directors, you know, the subject would still come up. We've got to find talent. We've got to find another resource of talent. We've got to do something with inner cities. We've got to do something, get more athletes involved. And then I moved back to Southern California, and I was working for the San Diego Padres as a scout. And same thing, I'm talking, this is like 84, 85, and I'm talking to the same subject with a different group of scouts. Hmm. So finally, in 1987, I got together with Roland Heeman, who was the general manager of the White Sox and general manager of the Orioles, but in between that was working in the commissioner's office, and expressed my concerns, and he suggested that I write a proposal and send it to, at the time, Commissioner Peter Uberoff, and that's exactly, you know, what we did. Sent the proposal to Peter Uberoff. He gave us funding for the first year, and RBI appeared to be off and running.
Well, you began in South Central L.A., where you grew up. What happened the first day of tryouts?
Prior to the first day of tryouts, we went into the local junior high schools, and we had some really impressive alumni, you know, with us. So when we went into one junior high school, we went in with one of their former alumni, Eric Davis. We went to another junior high school with Daryl Strawberry, with Hubie Brooks, and it was very impressive. And the kids were all fired up about, you know, this new league. And we gave the kids the first year jackets to wear, and everybody was excited. And when we told them the locations of the parks, you know, it was just silence, and we really didn't pick up on it, you know, and we just didn't pick up on it. And the problem was the kids were concerned with the locations over crossing over gang territory, and so it was concerned. And we met with the recreation and parks people, and who incidentally, the RBI does not get off the ground had it not been for the City of Los Angeles Department of Recreation and Parks. Mm-hmm. They provide the facilities and really the manpower. But we went to the supervisors, and they provided rangers. You know, they have park rangers that were there, and we assured the kids that security would be no problem. We also, you know, went to the community police stations and made them aware of what we were doing. So They would, you know, they would drive by, and then they would, like, you know, get out, and they would walk the park, and their presence was felt.
Interesting. Well, I'm curious, too, whether you ever talked with any of gang members there, if you were at a park, and there was, I don't know, kids hanging around, whether you ever went over and talked to them.
Well, you know, actually, prior to the start of RBI, in part of the research, you know, I had a cousin that was a gangbanger. And, you know, I talked with him about this. I said, you know, this is one problem. You know, I was just saying, well, why would the gangbangers, you know, prevent these kids from doing something positive? See, a lot of scouts are afraid to come into South Central because of this problem. And one of the things I was telling him, I says, you know, this is something that if you have, if the scouts are afraid to come into the area, you're hurting the community. You're hurting the kids in the area because that's going to limit their opportunity to be exposed to, you know, professional baseball, to college baseball, to what have you. And what he told me was that the gangbangers really don't bother the activity at the park. And most of the activity at the park is done at night, and that it would not be a problem.
And so, has it ever been a problem?
Knock on wood, it hasn't. One thing that we, in Southern California, the big gangs are the Crips and the Bloods, which are with the red and blue colors. So we had to outfit our league the first couple of years, you know, without using red or blue. And, you know, if you've been involved in with your youngsters, try to outfit a 24-team league baseball without using red and blue. It becomes very difficult.
Because you probably don't want to do too many of those pinks and other kinds of color.
Exactly.
So what can baseball teach young people, even apart from other sports? I mean, I think all sports teach winning and losing and good sportsmanship. But what do you think is distinctive about the game of baseball and what it can teach, especially a young person?
The thing about baseball that I think is unique from every other profession, every other sport, is that it teaches you to really deal with failure. You look at a 300 hitter who's a star. He fails 7 out of 10 times.
Right.
And I think that's the number one. You know, it teaches you to you know, deal with adversity, dependency on the other members, and I think it teaches you humility. And I think those are really the key points.
There's another part of this program which I think is very interesting, which is to link baseball, to link athletics with learning. And I know that's a very important part of this RBI program. How do you make that link for a young person? Do they have to make sure their homework is done or have certain kinds of grades in order to be part of the team?
Well, let me kind of give you a little background on how the educational component was devised. When I wrote the commissioner, Peter Ubroff, the first time to get the program started. One of the points that I made with Peter Ubroff was that in 1986, from the draft, the June free agent draft, of the players that were signed from America through the draft, not counting the Dominican Republicans, but through the draft, 82% came from college. As compared to when I signed in the late 60s, most of the players that were signing came from high schools.
Interesting.
So my thinking was that for the workforce, that as major league clubs cut back on minor league clubs for economics, that eventually baseball is going to use the colleges similar to the way the NBA and NFL use the colleges, really to cut back on scouting and player development. That's the trend that we're taking. Also, I noticed that when we did our survey, that of the players from America that were in the major league, on major league rosters, 45% of them came from Southern California. That's from Fresno to San Diego. Then we did a survey on who was attending colleges. So we did a survey on the rosters from San Diego to Fresno, California. And we found that less than 2% were African American, less than 3% of the players were Latino. So that told me that if this is going to be our trend, and that if there's only 2%, you know, minority participation at the colleges, then 10 years from now, we won't have any American minorities playing baseball. So we felt that it was important to get the academic component in place.
Is there a kid you think that really exemplifies what this RBI program is all about? A kid that really, I don't know, uses this experience to his own betterment?
Well, I think the one kid that I, and he's always been my favorite, In fact, he played, I think, day one by the name of James Lofton. Came into the program at 13. Horrendous home life. Mother was on drugs. Very low self-esteem. Very small in stature. Came in at 13, played on every RBI team that we had. I always kid and say that he probably has more RBI uniforms than we do. But he got bigger, he got stronger, he got more self-confidence. And when he graduated from high school, he was like the city player of the year, and he attended L.A. Community College. And that really surprised me because I didn't think that when this kid first came into the program, that he would do the things that he's accomplished. He signed a contract with the Cincinnati Reds, and he's currently playing in their minor league system. I don't know if James is going to play in the major leagues, but the day that he entered L.A. City Community College was probably the proudest day for me and the program to see how far he had come. And here's a kid that played in the program, never paid one dime to play in the program. So we were able to give this youngster a great experience, uniforms, trophies, and for absolutely free. And I really believe that this is a life that we've saved.
Well, John Young, it's been a real pleasure to have you with us today on Fresh Air, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Marty. It was my pleasure.
John Young is the founder of RBI, reviving baseball in inner cities. Their World Series begins this weekend in Denver.